From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, actor Jane Lynch chairs this year's AIDS Walk Wisconsin and thinks back to a time in the theater when the AIDS crisis was just beginning.
We didn't know what was happening, and, you know, tons of people died. People I knew, people, you know, everybody knew. Everybody was touched by this. And it was so scary because we didn't understand what it was.
Later, a play at Next Act Theater tells the story of the little appreciated work done by pioneering women astronomers of the early 20th century.
The work that they were doing was incredibly tedious. I mean, the patience that it required for these women to do this work for day upon day upon year is mind-blowing.
And writer Catherine Rundle shares her captivating tale of four young children and their adventure in the Amazon rainforest. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. You might know Jane Lynch from her work on Glee as the overwhelming gym teacher Sue Sylvester. Or maybe you know her from one of Christopher Guest's mockumentary films like Best in Show or A Mighty Wind.
Now she's playing the role of honorary chair for this year's AIDS Walk Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about working in the theater during the AIDS crisis and why this issue remains near to her heart.
First of all, Jane Lynch, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be speaking with you.
And congrats on the Emmy.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a big surprise. Was not expecting it. Very, very happy.
That's so, that must be like just amazing, right?
It is. And, you know, it's for a web series that I did that, you know, you do basically because you love it, not because you're making money at it. And it was a team effort, and it's called Dropping the Soap, by the way, and you can download it on Amazon and for free if you're on Amazon Prime, which everybody is. And also it's on iTunes and Google Play, but it's hilarious. It's about a soap opera that's circling the drain, trying to stay relevant, and I play an executive producer who comes in to shake it up. And it's just really funny. It's all my friends. You'll see a lot of famous people in there, and you'll see some not-so-famous people who are hilarious and really written well and whatever. So, yeah, so for that reason, a thrill to actually go up there and accept an Emmy for it.
Super fun, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're originally from Dalton, Illinois, near the south side of Chicago. Have you been to Milwaukee before?
I have been to Milwaukee, but not a lot. I think I went, the first time I went was touring with Second City. And I forget where we played. This was back in the 80s. But I remember I thought it was a great town, really cool town. Because when you live in Chicago, you think, what do I need to go to Milwaukee for? Milwaukee should come to me. And then I went to Milwaukee, and it's such a clean, beautiful, crisp place with the lake and gorgeous to look at. It's really wonderful.
Well, as you mentioned, you worked with the Second City, and you graduated from Illinois State University, ISU, mm-hmm. around the same time as the founders of Steppenwolf, all of whom went on to do amazing things. And it seems like so many people from that time at ISU just...
Fertile time. It was a fertile time for sure. There were some teachers there who, although psychologically complex, to say the least, were wonderful teachers and committed and were very well-versed in the method, and they had been trained in, a lot of them were actually from the cornfields in Illinois, but I had gone to New York and had learned, you know, the method back in the 50s, and they came back roaring with, techniques and, having us just dive into things, and of course there was talent to meet that. So it was one of those moments in time, a perfect storm of talent and teachers and direction and a beautiful university and, a lot of great people. A lot of great theater came out of there, and now a lot of people in film and television as well.
As someone who is from around Chicago, I went to school in Decatur, Illinois for a brief period. Actually, Milliken.
Oh, I know Milliken.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to Milliken. It's a beautiful school, nice, small.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, you have to be smart to get into that school.
I tried.
And you obviously did well.
But what did you think of living in Central Illinois coming from Chicago?
Well, I was from the south side, so I was from a suburb. But it was idyllic, actually. I loved it because, Illinois State, there's not a more beautiful campus. It's a typical Midwestern university town, Normal, Illinois, is, and it's beautiful trees, a gorgeous what do they call it? Not common, quad. They call it the quad. I was just back there too, and it's still gorgeous. You know, beautiful old buildings. So it was the kind of place that, you know, if you're looking for that typical collegiate experience where, you know, in the fall it's on fire with color, then Illinois State is for you. So I loved it. I loved being in that, and I also still love small towns. Even though I live in Los Angeles, I live in Laurel Canyon, and it's like a small town. We all know each other. We have our little grocery store at the corner, and yeah, I love the whole kind of ensconced feeling.
That's great. So you went on to work back in Chicago, Steppenwolf, Second City, now huge institutions.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like working at both of these places, really, at the time that they were kind of, you know, still starting out?
Well, Second City had been around since like the 60s, so we were 20 years into it by then. It was amazing. You know, Second City was not a place that was on my list of what I wanted to do. I really thought I wanted to be just a theater actor, and, you know, I did every audition that came my way, and I found myself at a Second City audition, and I got cast in the touring company, and turns out it kind of turned everything around for me because I loved doing sketch comedy. It suited my skill set. I loved throwing on a wig for one scene and throwing on a pair of weird glasses for the next scene and then doing little songs. And I loved being on the road. So it really worked out well for me. And knowing all the people who had come from it, you know, their pictures were all over the theater. You know, Bill Murray and going back to Alan Arkin and Nichols and May when they were the Compass Players back in the 60s. So, but John Belushi and I was going to say Gilda Radner, but she was Toronto. Betty Thomas, just all these really great, funny actor people. It was really wonderful to see their faces up on the wall, and I felt part of something very special.
How did your work there influence the rest of your career? Because so much of it has been in comedy.
Yeah, well, it did. That kind of put me on the comedy trajectory, if I were to look back and like connect dots and make a story of my life. Indeed, that kind of turned the corner for me where not only was I doing, actually, I never was on a stage at Second City. I toured, but I started getting calls for, you know, commercial auditions that where I would be funny. And then I got into a couple of movies in town, Vice Versa and The Fugitive. Oh, I wasn't funny at all in The Fugitive, but it showed, you know, if you can do comedy, you can really do anything. If you're really good at comedy, you can be very good at drama too, I believe. And I started doing comic commercials, and you know, and then I got to started doing the Real Live Brady Bunch at the Annoyance Theater, which was just in its infancy in Chicago. Now it's a big phenomenon there, and we did actual episodes of the Brady Bunch on stage. And Jill Soloway, the creator of Transparent, was the brainchild behind it. And we toured all over the country, and we ended up in Los Angeles, and we all started working. Andy Richter played Mike Brady, and he, of course, is Conan's sidekick and a wonderful, funny guy in his own right. Jill Soloway, who else has done? Well, names you probably wouldn't know, but they all have done very well. And well, that just kind of kicked me into the comedy.
So we've been talking about performing in Chicago, specifically in the kind of 80s. So, of course, you are the honorary chair of AIDS Walk Wisconsin.
Yes.
And you were working in theater at really the height of the AIDS crisis.
The AIDS crisis, indeed, when it was a brand new thing that was freaking everybody out, and we didn't know what was happening, and, you know, tons of people died. People I knew, people, you know, everybody knew. Everybody was touched by this, and it was so scary because we didn't understand what it was.
How did it impact you personally? I mean,
well, the first thing, I know it's a tough question.
Yeah, it's
to ask,
a tough
it's
question.
A tough one to answer. So let me just dive in and say I was at Cornell University, and I was in the graduate program, the acting graduate program, the MFA program, and I was doing a play called Early Dark. And it was directed by an up and coming New York director, and his name was Stuart White. And he cast me in this role where I was playing this like very vulnerable Southern girl, something I had never played before. I was always the wacky person. And he really believed in me, and we had a really, like, he was kind of like a dad to me, although he was only in his early 30s. I think he was 33. And he had a cold the entire time we were rehearsing the play, and he was like, I can't shake this cold, and, you know, I'm tired, and, oh, God, this is the worst time for this to happen. I'm directing a play, and maybe it's allergies. And about 6 months later, I heard he was dying, and it was from that disease that nobody knew anything about that was killing all these gay men. And he did pass away. And that was just such a shock. And then people just started dying. And, you know, friends and friends of friends. And, you know, you're going to memorial after memorial. And there was so much suffering, not just, you know, physically, but emotionally. There was so much suffering. And, you know, there was also the backlash of the hate. And yeah, it was a really tough time, and, you know, it's still a disease today. It's not like it went away. It's just not at the forefront, and indeed, we have terrific therapies that are keeping most people alive. But it still needs funding. We still need to help our brothers and sisters who are afflicted with this, and also prevention is so important. We have a whole new generation of, you know, you think you're going to live forever when you're 20, and so you're off there doing crazy stuff, and like we all do. But we have to continue educating people that this can kill you. And that's why I'm continuing to, you know, be a part of the resistance, if you will, to borrow a phrase. And I've been on the board at the LA Gay and Lesbian Center here in Los Angeles, and you know, I've done the AIDS walk, the AIDS ride. I've done all the AIDS things where I've challenged myself physically, and I haven't done anything in a while. So when they invited me at the Milwaukee Center to be their honorary chair, I was like, yeah, right on. Let's do this.
Well, Jane Lynch, thank you so much for taking out the time to speak with me. And
sure.
We look forward to having you in Milwaukee.
I can't wait.
Jane Lynch is an Emmy Award-winning actor and this year's honorary chair of the AIDS Walk Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The 28th annual walk and run will be this Saturday, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There's been a lot of recent attention paid to women's accomplishments in math and science, thanks to the film Hidden Figures, which showcased the contribution of four African-American women to the U.S. space program back in the 1960s. Yesterday, we met Dr. Kathy Sullivan, the first American woman to walk in space.
And currently on stage at Next Act Theater is Silent Sky. It's a play about pioneering women in the early 20th century and their unheralded discoveries in astronomy, discoveries like the scale of the universe. I met with Director David Cesarini, along with the cast, Carrie Hitchcock, Kelly Dougherty, Deborah Staples, Reese Madigan, and Karen Estrada. And Cesarini explains who these women, known as computers, were.
These computers, back in the Harvard Observatory, were taking the photographic plates that the men with the telescopes were taking of the stars, and these women would catalog the stars one by one off of these 8-inch by 10-inch plates. What do they call them? Little grains of pepper?
It looks like ground pepper.
Yeah. It is utterly remarkable what they did. They cataloged the southern hemisphere. They had an observatory down there sending back photographic plates, as well as the observatory there at Cambridge. And one woman, Annie Jump Cannon, alone cataloged over 200,000 stars.
I'm credited with classifying 400,000 stellar bodies, thank you very much,
yes.
And discovering more than 300 variable stars, 5 novae and 1 spectroscopic binary.
So, which I'm sure Jean will be able to tell us what that is.
Yes, she will. Exactly.
Well, the thing is, and these women did exist. They actually did all of this work, and like so many women over history, never got any credit for it until much later. Mm-hmm. At the time, were people aware of them?
Certainly the head of the observatory, Edward Pickering, was aware. And he chose women because he found that they could do the job much better than men. And through time, he did acknowledge contributions and discoveries of these women. And it was, I think, in the male world of science and astronomy at the time, he was progressive. But he takes a couple of shots in this play for good reason.
Yeah, he does. And for the three of you who are playing real women, did you know about them before you started learning the lines and learning about this world?
Not at all.
No, I was very unaware of these women. Granted, I do not have a very great science background personally, so I didn't know a whole lot about astronomy going into this, but I definitely was completely unaware of the amazing contributions that these women had in this field. It's really amazing and kind of mind-blowing how much work they did and how detailed and painstaking this work was, and they continued to persevere year after year.
Yeah, how many years did these women work there? It was at least a decade, right? Longer?
Longer. I think my character in real life started there at the age of 25, and I believe she was there for a couple decades.
You know, it's fascinating because at the time, I mean, there were some women in science who were well-known. I mean, Marie Curie won her Nobel right around that time, but women were still pretty much excluded from this. And so the fact that they were doing this work at all is pretty amazing, and that anyone recognized their capacity to do this work.
Right, and that brings us to really the salient journey in the play, is that these ladies occasionally, out of their interest, curiosity, and intelligence, were making discoveries. And this young Henrietta Leavitt comes to this group and is all primed for making her own discoveries and establishing her own mark and her own work. And within this world, it was frowned upon. You know, hey, may I use the telescope? No! Okay. And yet, she did find something that grabbed her curiosity, and eventually, Ms. Leavitt made an incredibly significant discovery, a connection in the behavior of some particular stars, which eventually led to the determining of actual distance to in the universe, measuring stars, and completely altered the consciousness of astronomers as far as what the universe was, how it was comprised, how big it was.
Where we were in it.
Where we were,
yeah.
And yeah.
Deb, since you are playing Henrietta, and she's such a great, great character, what have you discovered about her in the world of the play now? Not so much in real life, but in the world of the play, there's a humor in her and just that passion.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to bring up first, what you brought up first, is the sense of humor. We were just talking about how it's a fine line between here's this woman who is just inherently confident in her ability to accomplish something scientifically and in her intelligence and what she wants to do in the world. But she's playing in an arena that she's not been in. And so how do you kind of balance that, being a woman and being in this sort of man's world and not knowing the surroundings until you get yourself in there, but also being confident? And a lot of it lies in this wacky little sense of humor that she has. She's just ever so slightly subversive and
sly.
That's good. She's just really fun. She's somebody who you think, oh, she's really fun to work with. Which would really help a lot, because the work that they were doing was incredibly tedious. Mm-hmm. I mean, the patience that it required for these women to do this work for day upon year is mind-blowing.
400,000 stars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot of looking at very little pinpoints of light on negatives.
Right.
But it was still so thrilling for these women to be involved in it. I remember reading in The Glass Universe, they were just, many of the computers at Harvard did stay. I mean, they were kind of married to their work. They just loved doing it, loved having that opportunity.
This is a time, what Pickering did and focused on at the observatory was to combine photography with astronomy. Because up until this point, the skies were studied through observation. Some person looking through a scope and deciding how big, how bright, what color. Now they were able to examine the same area of sky over a period of time. They could tell if some stars were glowing brighter or something was there that wasn't there before. You had a whole new element of time, as well as getting a prism into it and examining the spectra, the nature of the light. So they were finding out much more what about the stars.
Well, and of course, you know, we had relativity kind of popped up, and how that changes the entire universe and our perception of it. So it was a huge changing time in
which
science.
Kind of brings up Reese's character.
Yeah, and we have here Karen and Reese. You two are characters in the play and very important ones, but you didn't actually exist, unlike these three ladies. But in this world, you're hugely important, and you represent all kinds. Well, you represent the way she figures out what's happening.
Well, that's part of it. But I yes, it's
Margaret is a composer, and so she is playing her music for Henrietta when Henrietta discovers this connection that she's been trying to make with these pulsing Cepheid stars. But I think Lauren Gunderson could have written a play just about the scientific discovery and these women in particular, but it's also about the nature of being a scientist and also living in a human world. I think Margaret's function in the play and for her sister is to bring her back to human relationships and human understanding of each other, which becomes very important later in the play, of when you try to measure your worth in the world and how much are you worth to the scientific world, how much are you worth to the people in your life. And also she kind of represents this life that Henrietta has to eschew in order to become what she wants to become. Even though she's, at the time, she's almost a glorified accountant of stars, right? And they're too smarter than that. That's what the men tend to see them as, the bookkeepers of the stars. But she has to give up.
She has to give up everything we sort of, in that time frame, you would think of as being a value for a woman. So, you know, having the family and the home and
husband,
children,
and child,
and
right.
All of that stuff, these women largely forewent, Henrietta in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's interesting to sort of, I don't know, it's almost like Lauren Gunderson split a person in half and made, you know, each half a sister to sort of point that up in the play.
And so, Reese, what do you think your character is doing?
Well, the character description is the man, so, you know.
you're all the guys.
And to some degree, you know, I mean, he represents, well, Peter's interesting. I think he straddles two worlds. He's representative of this patriarchy, of this oppressive culture of the men are the only people who are allowed to use the telescopes, and he's very much a part of that. He's Dr. Pickering's fictional apprentice, and so his function is to bring the photographic plates from the telescope to these women. But at the same time, he's someone who is closed-minded, who is very much representative of that the culture that cannot see anything beyond the Milky Way galaxy. He's somebody who doesn't believe that the universe is that large. He thinks that all that we see is all that there is, and his eyes are opened by Henrietta gradually over the play, and he's someone who all of a sudden, I think, realizes, oh my goodness, the universe really is unimaginably vast. He literally gets his mind blown by this woman and her brilliance.
And falls in love with her,
and
too.
And her precision, yes. Well, who wouldn't, you know?
I don't know. I don't know. I would think she would be somewhat terrifying to some people, particularly in that culture.
Well, yeah, but I think that he admires her mind and her spirit. You know, I mean, I think I think it's really interesting to have a man of this era in love with a woman, not because he can cage her and make her what he wants, but he's in love with how she opens his eyes to what the world can be, not just romantically, but, you know, astronomically, I guess, cosmologically.
What kind of role is Jean Creighton playing for you? Because I know she's helping you, I think, kind of grapple with the science part of this, right? Is that the first time you've brought in a scientist?
We've met with medical professionals. I think that's
okay.
the
closest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But no, Jean, I met up with Jean in the summer because I had, it occurred to me, to do a special event for some of our donors to come by. So we staged a reading over at her planetarium, her home, her little playground over at UWM. And so I was in consultation with Jean, checking in on some of the sciences to try to get a handle on the understanding of it. And she's been helpful in reaffirming or setting us straight on things. She's going to be coming to the show at least, and we'll do a talk back. And has asked that we get her any more questions possible to answer. But yeah, she's just wonderful because she, you know, in a similar way, Gunderson can write this play that's got complex science within it, but she does not at all overwhelm us with the science. It's a human story and very engaging in that way. Humorous and poignant and surprising and exhilarating at points. And then it breaks through toward the end with some, on more what Karen was saying, the human level of really a profound meaning, combining the vastness of the stars with the vastness of the human spirit, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the thing that makes this whole play so appealing, is the fact that, yes, there's all this wonderful science and you can think about, you know, discovering the universe in that way, but it's because it's human beings mm-hmm. who are doing this that makes those of us who aren't astrophysicists able to connect to it. And as I was reading it, I thought, this is wonderful. Even though I don't really know what it is that you were doing, you know, and what you actually discovered, you know, I know about distance. I kind of get there was like pulsations and there was like rhythm and stuff, but I don't really get that. But I get that it was an amazing thing, and there was this person who did it.
Right.
This one person.
Right, right.
And there she was.
And the whole question of what is the point? You know, they've been doing this work for years and years, basically taking notes on what's out there. And why? What is the point of that? How do you know that that matters? And to find that, as David has explained it before, which I think is really good, this woman, through this hard labor, found a key, and for a long time she wondered, is this a key to anything? Is there a lock that this works in? And finally then, yes, in fact, other people, largely men, then took that key that she found, that she fashioned, that she created, and used it to unlock enormous amounts of knowledge, basically being able to accurately tell how far away things are in the universe, basically telling us where we are. I mean, it's huge discoveries. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's a very human thing to wonder at a certain point in your life, what is the meaning of being here, and what is going to be left after I'm gone, and have I had an impact, and if so, what is the nature of that impact, or is my existence fleeting, and all of these things that tend to become important as you go along.
It's just the wonder of it, and just putting things in perspective to, you know, sometimes you can feel that what you're worried about making for dinner is so much less important than what might be out there.
Lauren chooses to use Annie's quotation on the front. You should read it. It's really brilliant. I think it's on the silent sky.
All right. Glasses on. In our troubled days, it is good to have something outside our planet. Something fine and distant for comfort.
David Cesarini directs the Next Act Theater production of Silent Sky, which is now open. It stars Deborah Staples, Kelly Dougherty, Carrie Hitchcock, Karen Estrada, and Reese Madigan. There is more information at WUWM.com. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. If the new middle grade novel, The Explorer, feels like the product of another era, maybe that makes sense, because its author, Catherine Rundell, could be from another era as well. Despite her fairly young age, Rundell has four novels under her belt, not to mention proficiency at walking a tightrope and experience as a bush pilot.
Oh, and by the way, she is a fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. The Explorer, though, is set in the Amazon nearly 100 years ago. It tells the story of four children whose plane has crashed and who teach themselves survival skills in the rainforest before they encounter a mysterious man they call, well, the Explorer, of course. We were lucky enough to host the author in the Lake Effect Studios before a recent Boswell Book Company reading. Kate Rundell, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm thrilled to be here.
If we were having this conversation, say, 100 years ago, would you be writing about adventure or setting out on adventure?
I think 100 years ago, when there was still so much to find out about, I would have been very tempted to become an actual real-life adventurer. But these days, mm-hmm. with the internet and Google Maps, I think maybe the way forward is to write books that offer to children the chance to see something clearly that they might not otherwise be able to see.
Well, right. We're talking, and you're writing at a time when a child's world is larger thanks to the internet, and also smaller thanks to whether it's overscheduling or overprotective nature of parenting these days. What was adventurous in your own childhood?
So I spent quite a lot of my childhood in Zimbabwe, and it meant that we had this quite wild kind of life. We spent the afternoons without our shoes, and during the holidays we would go out into the bush and ride horses, and my best friend and I would play this game where you would antagonize a herd of cattle and then run down the hill and jump into a deep lake, which was just a horrifying idea. But our parents trusted us to roam free. And in that, I think we were very, very lucky.
It's interesting because we think of childhood as this time when our imagination is so vibrant. But at the same time, you can also have these honest-to-God adventures without even having to imagine them.
Absolutely. And I think children are bold in ways that adults just aren't. Maybe because it would be very inconvenient as an adult to break your leg. But as a kid, you just don't think that way. And so things that, when I was a kid, I found completely run-of-the-mill now terrify me. I would not want these days to go bungee jumping. But back then, I would gladly leap off things and climb things. It wasn't that I was fearless. It was just that the idea that it might happen to me didn't really cross my mind. I thought I would be safe.
Were there things that frightened you as a child?
I have always had a certain giddiness around heights, and I love climbing, and I've always loved climbing trees and mountains, and then later in my adult life, buildings late at night. And it's not that I fear the heights. I have vertigo, which is the fear that you'll jump. Not that I want to. You just have this fear that something will overcome you and you'll lose the same bit of yourself and leap. And it's not going to happen. It never happens. But just that little ratty voice telling you that you might, that's vertigo. That I still have.
There is a scene in this book where I think it's the character Khan goes basically scurrying up a tree after Fred, who is, I guess, the protagonist, certainly the central character. She does it without even thinking and realizes that she's gotten up there without actually knowing how to climb a tree. Was that you?
A little bit, yes. I certainly did things that I would then halfway through deeply regret. Like there were certainly bits of rock that I would climb, and you go especially herring up after an older brother who you want to impress. And then suddenly you realize halfway up, you don't know how to get up, you don't know how to get down, and you're an absolute moron. That was very much a resonant feeling in my childhood.
So the book takes place in kind of the indeterminate past. Mm-hmm. I did some triangulation based on various details that show up, and my guess was maybe the late 20s or early 30s?
Exactly that, yeah. Very, very late 20s.
Were you consciously being vague about the era in which the book was set?
Yes. So you can work it out in the way that you did. There's a reference to Percy Fawcett, the explorer who went missing. And if you knew that he went missing in 1925, you could work out that when they say a few years ago, and then you could think about what a child would think of as a few years. But a lot of people have asked me if it's set in the 40s, and I wanted it to be open so that people could clothe it in whichever period interests them most vividly.
And there was kind of this golden era of adventure and exploration when a story like this could take place and could involve an airplane.
Absolutely. So there was a moment in the world in which you had people who were going out to explore. But I want to be really clear in the book that that kind of exploration had a darker side, and it was not always generous, and sometimes it was entirely disastrous for the indigenous people. And I want to make really clear that that was not a kind of exploring that we should valorize, but that there might be something that we can find whereby we tread lightly on the world, but still go to find out its secrets.
It's interesting because, again, Fred, when Fred and his three, I was going to call them colleagues, but that's
right, his gang, his companions. Right.
Fred and the three other children who make up the story encounter this mysterious explorer who goes to great pains to say he's not an explorer when they meet him. He comes into that meeting with one impression of exploration, and I think probably a lot of your young readers have that same impression as they get into this book.
I think that might be the case. I think there's something so heroic about the idea of the explorer setting off and the exploits that they go through, real-life explorers, the sort of grisly detail which kids love about people ending up with maggots growing in the crooks of their elbows. But I wanted kids to look at it and then question it. And with a book, ideally, you can offer someone something new, something maybe better than the first idea that they came at you with. And I want to say, you know, that kind of explorer, it might smell a little bit of empire. It might have some exploitation in it. And there are new and better ways that we can go forwards.
It's funny, you talk about the maggots in the crook of your arm, and it's impossible to read that mention in the book or listen to you say that without subconsciously checking the crook of your arm.
I know, to make it's sure hideous, no... isn't it? You immediately go to the skin just to check there haven't been things growing out of your skin. It's such a vivid image.
Well, and I gather a real one.
A real one, based on Percy Fawcett's colleague on his, I think it was his second exploration. And not just him. I think just the idea of maggots under your skin is for some people just a run-of-the-mill suggestion.
So do I understand correctly there was a real-life exploration of yours, maybe not in exactly the same way, but you actually traveled to the Amazon to do research for this book.
That's absolutely right, though no maggots and no elbows. But I went a few years ago with a best friend and a guide who had worked with indigenous people to do a sort of survival course, the idea that he would teach us how to survive, how to map the sun, how to catch tarantulas, how to catch piranha, where you can swim and where you can't, where to find water. And I put all of that in the book. And at the end of our survival, we said, you know, do you think we'd survive? And he said, no, you'd be dead in like 15 hours. So I don't think we were wildly successful, but in my book, the children are more successful than me.
Did the idea to go to the Amazon exist before the idea about writing a book about the Amazon?
I've wanted to see the Amazon since I was a kid. There are some brilliant children's books that are quite famous in the UK. One of them is called Journey to the River Sea by Ava Ibbotson, and I just adored it. It's set in the Amazon River. But also, I saw so many documentaries as a child that showed this place of ravishing beauty, and I wanted to swim in that river.
Do you feel like you got what you were looking for out of going to the Amazon?
Oh, I got several hundred times more than what I was looking for. I didn't expect it to be so excessively more beautiful than I had thought. I thought I knew what beauty was. I grew up in Africa, but this was breathtaking. This felt otherworldly. It felt like the kind of place that you shouldn't just be able to go to free, just get on an airplane and then you're there. It felt like you should have to wrestle a troll and it should be the reward.
There's this, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's this nagging issue that the explorer has about wanting to keep the Amazon. And, you know, even today, 85 or 90 years after this book is set, I think there still seems like there's something to that issue.
Absolutely. I mean, the anxiety that my explorer character has is about the treatment of indigenous people and the devastation of the rainforest. And those are still things that are so urgently important. And I want kids to read this book if they do and think, what can we do? And of course, you know, we can do the very basic things. We can give money to charities that are trying to protect the rainforest. We can try to lobby our politicians not to participate in places that decimate these places, because once they're gone, they won't come back.
Do you think about how kids devour books as you write for kids?
I do. When I was a kid, there are so many different ways you can read. There's the book that you read in two or three sittings so hungrily. And then there's the book that you almost, it gets too exciting and you have to flip to the end to find out what happens at the end. And there were certain models that you're just dying to replicate yourself. And I don't think I've got there yet, but I'm working on it, working on creating a book whereby you almost can't read it because it's so exciting. Those books of my childhood, those stuck with me.
It's a lot of pressure, though, to put on this page to make you want to read the next page.
It is. And of course, you have to reckon with writing that you do your best and your best will fail, but that each time you write a book, you do get slightly better, maybe slightly more understanding of the ways that a structure of a book. I see a book architecturally now in a way that I didn't used to.
It's interesting. As I was reading this, I was thinking about that phenomenon of the page turner, and how at one level it seems so appealing when I'm reading a book aimed at a younger audience, middle grades or a young adult. And at the same time, I feel like when it's consciously done for adults, it's annoying.
Right, exactly. You know, and of course it can be brilliantly done, but it is sometimes so obvious. The, you know, the cliffhanger at the end of the chapter, the it was the last time she would ever see him. But, you know, with adults, it makes me want to bite something. With children, I'm far more forgiving, partly because children have read so far fewer books that they are more ready to engage with quite obvious tropes. But yeah, in adults fiction, it makes me want to yell.
But that's not to say you have also written, you're a playwright as well, and presumably your audience is older. And I mean, I guess if you're at a play, you would want to stay there from the beginning.
Exactly. Yes, I wrote a play about a British writer called Saki that came to New York, and it was fascinating to see how British audiences and American audiences react differently to the same jokes. People laugh at very different things. I think in America, you are slightly more generous. You laugh less at cruelty and more at sarcasm.
Interesting. And I've just put two and two together about I'm having a strange flashback to how I reacted to A Fish Called Wanda.
Great film.
And I, in fairness, I need to go back to it years later because I felt like they were just being cruel to people, and they are. Mm-hmm. But my, at the time, 14 or 15 year old sensibility was disturbed by it. At the same time, do you see British kids and American kids reacting any differently to your books for them?
I don't think I know American kids well enough. I spend a lot of time going to British schools and meeting British kids. I've just done some school visits and the kids were completely enchanting here in Milwaukee. But the way a kid will react to a joke about, say, a wolf peeing on an adult is very similar the world over.
It's universal.
I think that's just a universal thing.
And I don't know how old you are. I won't ask you to tell me how
old
you are.
I'm 30.
Okay. At 30, do you have any difficulty conjuring up the spirit of adventure from your past?
Not at all, no. I remember my childhood so vividly. And also, I started writing children's fiction when I was 20, 21, when I still felt very much that I was close enough to childhood to dig into it. And so for me now, to remember what my childhood was feels easy. And I meet so many kids, and they're so useful. They're such great research, their passions, their obsessions. And I also have incredibly embarrassing diaries from my childhood. So I can tell you, you know, what it was that obsessed me then, and I can put that in my fiction.
You mentioned you spent many of your formative years in Zimbabwe. You also spent some of your childhood in Belgium. What is adventure like in Belgium?
My time in Belgium between age 14 and 18 was singularly lacking in adventure. I found it a beautiful country, but it rains all the time. And coming from a country where there was sun and such space to run, it felt quite claustrophobic to me. And so the first book I wrote, which is Cartwheeling in Thunderstorms here, is about someone moving from Zimbabwe to the claustrophobia of a British boarding school. And it's that same leap that I've just slightly twisted and given an English slant.
Is it true that you try to spend some time cartwheeling every day?
That is still mostly true, but I live between two places, Oxford and London. And in London, my flat is so minute that there would not be space to cartwheel and you can barely stand.
But it is not a metaphor.
It is not a metaphor. No, it's just a practical thing. If you do, I mean, the same way sort of yoga, if you do a few cartwheels and a couple of handstands, you're much less likely to climb back into bed.
Or jump out of a tree.
Or jump out of a tree.
Well, it really is a delightful book. And Kate Rundle, I'm glad you spent some time with us and we could share it with people.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Rundle is the author of four novels, including Rooftoppers, The Wolf Wilder, and her latest, The Explorer. She's also a screenwriter, a playwright, a tightrope walker, a bush pilot, and a fellow at All Souls College in England.